Wax on, wax off.
Yeah, we'll say, yeah. And wax off.
So this should prove interesting with an open. Let's see who shows up.
Well, the important people are already there, so.
Oh, cool. I got that. Yeah, how did your daydreaming go, or nighttime dreaming go?
It's been really weird lately. I've been catching myself waking up in the middle of dreams. But
no kidding.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons is that when I had to travel a lot for my job,
right?
I slept in a lot of different places very often.
Right.
And it takes me like 3 days to adapt to a new sleeping environment.
Yeah.
And I was usually away for 2 days.
Yeah.
So it's like you never really got into the rhythm and then you had to come back. Well, since the my daughter and the kids are here, I'm sleeping downstairs.
Oh, okay.
Because of the size of the rooms and how we have to distribute people and whatnot. And
yeah,
I get up earliest and I'm not the last one to go to bed. My wife is, but so I'm sleeping downstairs. So I'm now in another environment. When everybody was here for the baptism, I was in another room, you know? So it's like, I've been migrating through the house for about 3 days stretches. And it's only after a while do I actually, you know, adapt to it. So,
yeah, right. I agree with you, because that's something that the way I would language it, the intelligence of the body has to feel a certain, has to adapt to a new environment and feel a certain level of safety, if I can put it that way.
That could be part of it. I never feel insecure with that, but sometimes I sleep best with my head to the north and my feet to the south.
Okay.
And in the different places in this house, that varies. So I'm actually changing my polarity, so to speak.
Yeah, and that's kind of saying the same thing, but talking from a biological, you're talking from a very internal, subtle body.
Yeah. Well, you know, wherever you feel at home, I guess. But
that feeling at home.
Right. So I've been waking up, and they are, as I would expect, bizarre. They're always bizarre. I've always had bizarre dreams. I can't remember when I didn't have a dream that wasn't bizarre. Truly bizarre. It always says, you know, you can't get killed in a dream. I've been shot. It's probably one of the most vivid. It's the most vivid dream I ever had, because I still remember to this day. And I dreamt it 40 years ago.
Do you remember when you first started having dreams, how old you were?
No, I couldn't tell you that.
Yeah, I can't. I just wonder. Some people seem to remember. I don't.
Yeah, there's my wife is a person who has a lot of very distinct memories from early in her life.
Yeah.
Okay, and my oldest daughter tends to be that way, but not to the extent that my wife is. But my youngest daughter and me are both kind of, I think it was before I was a teenager kind of thing. Or I think it was in my teens. Or, you know, there's really, because I can't narrow it down. I have, for me, once it's in the past, it gets very atemporal. It's hard for me to place it, even getting it into some kind of sequence, you know, that happened before that. I get that wrong all the time, because I'll be talking about something and, you know, describing this and blah, blah, blah. And then my wife would go, no, that was like 5 years before. You know, oh, okay. Well, whenever that was, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't have that specificity that some people do, you know. I tried for years keeping a dream journal, and you know, if I woke up with a dream, trying to write it down and things like that, but it always got away faster than I could get it on paper, you know, and after a while it was just like, okay, well, I'm not going to be able to do this. So I just gave it up and didn't follow it.
I had a similar experience a long time ago when I was working with the idea of dream journals and even lucid dreaming. And I just kind of let that go and go, well, how well can I pay attention in daylight? And
then maybe that'll help. You know, I was like, well, maybe that'll help to get this together. I never got it. I read a lot of literature about lucid dreaming. I find it fascinating. Yeah. I really am intrigued when I read, you know, the stories of what, you know, people are doing and whatnot. But it's just like, well, okay, why? And I suppose it's a teachable and learnable skill.
Yeah.
I've never had the opportunity to go through any kind of learning experience or, you know, teaching to have it take effect. So it's just like, okay, it's never really been high on my priority list.
Yeah, well, and for me, I have to have a certain, I'll use the Gebser intensity of interest to even follow.
Yeah, through. Oh, yeah, that plays a role.
I just noticed that, and I used to kind of fight that and feel like I'm supposed to, you know, do what, you know, I wouldn't allow myself to feel the intense interest. I'd just be doing it because I'm supposed to. And
yeah,
I dropped that supposed to and started following listening to my interest and how intense it was. And that helped me in my, you know, because I've shared with you even yesterday that it now this is the way I take it. It's helped me to pay attention to a certain dreaminess in day-to-day life that comes upon you if you're paying
attention. I'm not quite Walter Mitty, but I have that Mitty-esque daydreaming. I do a lot of daydreaming. I'll catch myself sitting here at my desk just staring out the window.
Right.
But things are going through my mind and I have ideas and I have thoughts, you know, that's basically, you know, anything that I ever wanted to write, that's kind of how it came up.
Yeah. Okay.
I noted those down and, you know, I journal and I, you know, I have notebooks and stuff like that. And I put that stuff down, but the time comes when you have to like sit down and work on it.
Right.
And I don't always have those chances to do that. I had more chances to do that when I was working since I retired, you know?
Yeah. Right.
Cause I actually had the very good fortune of never being closely supervised. I was never in a job where my boss was like always looking over my shoulder.
Oh, you're lucky.
Yeah. I think the reason is they didn't want to see what I was doing or what was going on, you know, because
plausible deniability.
Well, for any number of reasons. One of the things is, over the course of my life, I almost always had two jobs. I had a day job, and then it was either some kind of volunteer thing that I did, but for a long time, for example, when we moved back to Germany and I started tutoring for the Open University for almost 15 years, I had a second job, which was tutoring. So I had to mark papers and I had to, you know, respond to students online. It was mostly an online, a distance learning situation.
Oh.
But we got together three times for, the course was 6 months long. We got together three times over those 6 months for day schools, usually down in Frankfurt or, you know, somewhere I could travel for a day. But I also had day schools in Brussels and in Holland, and because they sent me all over the continent as well. So I would have to travel Italy. I used to love to go down there. I have to go to Milan for like 2 days.
Oh, my God.
One day was a day of class. And if three students showed up, I was always happy.
Oh, wow.
So it was like me and three students for 6 hours on a Saturday, you know, doing this kind of thing. And then, of course, you have, you know, the night before you arrive, you leave the next morning kind of thing because you're not, you know, you're not getting out late. So I got to, you know, see a lot of places, and it was the interaction with the students was very intense. But it was an auxiliary, you know, my bosses knew, the company knew I was doing that. They thought it was great. Oh, he's also tutoring at a university, you know, as well as being, you know, so we can brag with that.
Oh, so they were comfortable with that.
They were very comfortable with it, they say. And I took that as license, since you know I'm doing this, that if I happen to be marking papers in the office, then you can't get all wigged out about it.
Yeah, right.
But it never got to that situation where they could or not would not get wigged out about it, for the simple fact that, so I think I had mentioned this to you once before, if my boss said he wanted it on Friday, he got it on Friday. He didn't get it on Tuesday. You know, when I might have finished it 20 minutes later.
Yeah.
But he didn't get it till Friday because that's when he wanted it. So
that's good strategy. That's good.
And I understand. Okay. So the time in between, I was always busy, and I did a lot of things for the company, because the projects that we were doing sometimes involved, you know, a lot of outside reading, or I was, you know, doing a lot of, I did a lot of emailing with the other project partners, because we had milestones we had to meet and reports that had to be written and things like that. And since I was a native English speaker, everything went through me for final editing and proofreading and copy editing and whatnot. So I spent a lot of time getting things delivered so that I would have time to do that, you know, the things that were necessary to improve it language-wise or whatnot, which was greatly appreciated by all the people who are writing in English and it's not their native language. You know, that's a real challenge. It takes you a long time to do that. It takes me about twice as long to write something in German as it takes for me to write it in English.
Okay.
Just because of,
even
though I'm considered relatively fluent in the language, it's just, it takes a long time to formulate. Writing is a different process than speaking. You know, you can get it out a lot more easily.
Yeah, right.
So a lot of times I was working two jobs that, you know, while I was there. Mm-hmm. In the beginning, for the first 5 years, all of the papers that were submitted by the students, and they had three assignments that they had to turn in that I marked during the course of the course, so to speak. Between 3 and 5, depending on which course it was I was teaching. And they were all about 3,000 words long, and then they had to be marked. And I like to turn them around relatively quickly, but it wasn't just a matter of going through and say, oh, this is an A or a B or whatnot. I made a lot of comments in the text itself so that they would know when they're doing the next assignment. Mm-hmm. What do you have to pay attention to? And where are the weak points? And what did you do real well? That kind of thing. So there's a lot of feedback that I wrote. Sometimes I wrote more than the students did.
Oh, wow.
So, which they didn't always appreciate. because then they had to read it. And I said, but you make me read yours. You know, so.
Yeah.
if you did what I asked you, I wouldn't have so much to say.
Sure. Well, yeah, I've always had, I prefer speech to writing. I write little. I write only when I need to focus a little bit, but I'm just not, I just realize I'm just not, probably for a lot of reasons that I just don't want to challenge.
Right.
You know, but I'm a poor speller. I'm a poor speller of my thoughts. It's like one time I responded to Johnny and it was just my way of saying that I agree with slowing down, but mm-hmm. for me, I can't slow down too much. If I slow down too much, it's like a reverse effect.
Yeah. I get
it. You know, it's like, it's trying to understand that some people can only slow down a certain amount, not to maybe what everybody else, you know. And part of that, I think, it has to do with my work. I mean, I worked outside. I moved everywhere.
Yeah.
And so mm-hmm. I have this. Internal actual physical connection to right. movement and thinking and, you know, that kind of thing. We were talking about that yesterday.
Right.
But, so I think that's part of it. And, but I, at the same time, I love reading, and I like what, Ursula Le Guin said, that reading is learning how to listen.
Well, it is. I agree, you know, because we tend to internally vocalize when we're doing things. I like to read dialogue with voices so that I'm, you know, getting the one or the other. I just had the good fortune that if I wasn't sitting in my office, I was sitting in a plane, or I was sitting in a bus, or sitting in a streetcar somewhere, and I had an hour and a half commute to work each day, down, and an hour and a half back at night. Mm-hmm. So when the students turned things in on paper, which was the first 5 years, I could mark things when I was riding the subway, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So I had time to do those kinds of things, and I had time to devote to that. When they eventually, because we all had to be technologically up to date, it eventually all got online, and that bothered me to no end, because then I had to sit at the computer somewhere and do that.
Yeah.
So the things that I could do for work on the subway, I would do on the subway. And then I would, if I was sitting in the office and had some time, I would mark papers and things.
So. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, and I don't know if this is where I'm jumping in. You said about the computer, the physical interacting with the computer is different with pencil and paper.
Oh, it is. I'm a pencil and paper.
Right. Right. Yes. It's tactile. In terms of tactility, it's different, you know?
Oh, it certainly is. I was always the odd man out at our project meetings. We'd be all sitting in Turin or whatever it was, and said, okay, we have to make a date for the next thing. And everybody pulls out their phone.
And I
pull out my calendar, or as the English would call it, my diary. Where I mark down my dates. You say,
yeah, exactly. And
I would write it down, and they go, "Why do you do that?" I go, "So I can remember it."
Yeah,
because if I write it down,
it's right. That's right.
It actually stays longer with me than if I speak it in, type it in, and enter it on the computer. And I do keep a Google calendar so that I know where I need to be when I need to be there.
Okay.
So it sends messages then to my phone.
Yeah.
Yesterday I was up at the playground with the grandsons, mm-hmm. and my phone buzzed. I'm going, why is my phone buzzing? You know, I pulled it out and looked and said, oh, I had an appointment. You know, half an hour. It calls me a half an hour ahead of time. Oh, I have an appointment I have to get to. Okay, guys, we gotta pack it up and get home here.
Right.
Grandpa's got something to do. So that's helpful in that regard. But see, I put it in the computer and forgot it. If I would write those things down in my calendar like I should, then I would probably remember them longer.
Yeah, I agree. And it's probably because of my, well, actually, it's a blend, Ed, of how I read the Gospels when I read the Gospels of Jesus, and then Alan Watson's Zen, because the Gospels have a lot of association with nature, and Zen is always about being, you know, bringing that attention to your environment.
You know,
and that you're living in, and that's why I think of myself doing a better job of lucid dreaming in daylight, or you know.
Yeah. I know what you mean. Yeah, that's why I spend a lot of that same activity is what I invest when I'm reading, because a lot of times when I find myself staring out the window is because I was just reading something. I read a couple of paragraphs, and I'm trying to sort it out what it's doing.
Exactly.
You know, you go off into La La Land or wherever that is that I'm at, but I tend to think that after a while it helps.
Well, and some of the research, especially by Evan Thompson, who wrote a book called Dreaming Awareness and something else. I mean, it was it's a academic, but he's very well about wondering about these studies of studying meditators and when the mind wanders and wondering the gist of why does the mind do that? Do we have to keep it wandering? And one of the questions they ask, well, when they first catch the that they're wandering, you sure that you're catching it and it's just been going on?
Yes. Yeah.
I'm given a rough feel of what I've done is they actually are somewhat supportive that we need to kind of relax and enjoy that wanderingness of the mind.
I agree with you 100%. I have a book from one of the Martinist orders that I was associated with for a while, and And in there, they have kind of like a how they go about doing their meditation, right? Mm-hmm. You know, to get you into it, because most people don't before they start these kinds of things, and then everybody goes, okay, well, what am I supposed to do? You know, do I have to, you know, sit under the Bodhi tree and I don't have one on my back, or what is it? And that's why I told you, you know, the nice thing about the Rosicrucians, they use that Egyptian posture, which is like the pharaohs in front of the temple, where you're just sitting in a chair and just relax. But, and so they did it as well. But you start out by just, you know, like counting breaths and concentrating on, you know, your breathing, just so that you become aware you're doing all of these things.
Right.
And at the beginning, you know, like the first exercise is, okay, we'll try to block out not necessarily all the sounds or, you know, smells or what's in your environment, but all of that monkey chatter that comes up in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just give it a try at first.
Concentrating. Yeah.
But once you get to they tell you, once you get to the point where you're able to kind of nip some of that in the bud,
mm-hmm.
when one of them comes up, just go with it. Mm-hmm. And follow it, and see where it goes, so that you can, because you can end up in very different spaces and different places by doing that.
Yeah,
you know. So it was a nice combination of, you know, getting into the zone or getting quiet, which is really difficult for most people, I think.
Yeah,
and realizing that there is a subtle interplay between. It's not necessarily the chatter. The thoughts you have can be beneficial as well. You know, we've talked about that in a lot of cafes. You know, thoughts, a lot of thoughts come from the outside somehow.
They
don't pop up in our head. It's like that's why I like that radio metaphor, because we kind of like tune into it.
Our bodies are, you could take it in terms of it, In so many ways, on a scientific level, our bodies and nervous systems are an antenna.
Mm.
We're an antenna.
I think so as well. That's the feeling that I get. That you just that's the same thing we were talked about once in one of our talks, where you do that exercise. You actually stare at someone to get them to turn around, and they will turn around. Well, why is it that they do that?
Right.
You know, and I think it has something to do with sending and receiving. And probably vibrationally, you know,
and it's a part that we're not nurtured to actually accept, that it's actually part, it's natural to us in a certain sense.
I think it's natural.
And it's just as natural in my book as somebody being able to do a triple backflip.
Yeah. But it takes some practice to do that.
It's a different kind of ability.
Even if you have some talent, you have some ability, you still have to work at it.
Yeah, and so to play in this, I don't know if you checked out I forget where it was, of the lady Doug posted about the liminal dreaming. Did you ever check that out, liminal dreaming that Doug posted? There's a lady that's been working with liminal dreaming in the sense, and I kind of checked it out, and it plays into my part of my day-to-day practice that, she's basically tapping into the hypnagogic state in between.
I saw that hypnagogic transition between
that there's been sleeping. That's part of working with she's really have a lot of interesting to show that people can work with that, and it's more the hypnagogic is going from sleep, I mean from wake to sleep is easier to train than coming out, because then there's the other side of that coming out. That liminal place before you start sleep or dreaming, that I agree with her, because that I tend to do that naturally before I fall asleep. I'm relaxing, and you just expressed it in another way of wandering.
Yeah.
And what her in-depth things is, one of the things you have to get used to in that liminal space is it's loosening whatever filters we have between us and the infinite
person. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to be chaotic, and it's not going to have a necessarily a logical frame, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But to relax into it and see, like you were pointing to, follow it. Because yeah, maybe just it takes time to find out what the images are trying to, because what you're doing, from what I feel, just in a psychological sense, and it's just psychological, we do have that repression mechanism between us and the unconscious, you mm-hmm. know? Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that the more we work with these kind of things we're talking about, we're actually touching in and helping that and not be, that be so habituated tight.
Yeah.
You know, how we close, you know, how we can close things off.
Well, we can. Well,
you know, but at the same time, I agree with you that one part you said is, you know, I don't know if I understood it right, but it's basically, you know, sometimes it's good to actually relax. It's okay that we do things unconsciously too. You know, when you were saying, you know, yes. we not getting so obsessed that we have to micromanage what happens in our experience. Right.
Yeah. That when I actually stop and think about how many things I do unconsciously every day.
Yeah.
You know, right. I have to take the grandson to kindergarten. So driving, to me, sometimes it's a little scary because, you know, I was late for my appointment yesterday and I was going down the highway and I needed to turn left, but I would have driven to kindergarten.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
In the car, you see, yeah, but yeah, I had just right. dropped him off. So I was thinking, oh, you know, grandson's there and this, and so I was in a whole different space. And
yes, right.
It's a little disconcerting because I don't think I had to be on the road at those times.
Oh, okay.
You know, I would like to think that more people are less like me and paying more attention to what they're doing behind the wheel. But a lot of it is exceedingly automatic, you know. And I notice that on long trips that I take I like to drive. If I'm going to drive a long distance, it's like you were, you know, with your son, you're going up to Montana.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when there's another person in the car, there's a different dynamic. But if you're in a car all by yourself and you have to do a long distance, it takes a little bit of effort to make sure you're not zoning out somewhere along the line.
Yeah, interesting you say that because I did have that experience by myself of taking a Lexus 300 all the way up to Quarter Lane, Idaho, 5 years ago, March. I was helping a friend get the car up there, and you know, I left at 2 o'clock in the morning. It took me like 22 hours. I got up there at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the morning, and this was during March, and it was still winter up in Idaho. I mean, it was
yeah.
I know of where you speak because I had a few monsters by me. I'm going, okay, wake up and roll down the window, you know. But one of the experiences too of this is I'm getting into Montana, and where you go to Missoula or you go to Butte, and I'm about 50 miles out. There's nothing but these high mountains, a full moon and moonlight on snow. Something about that was awe-inspiring to me. I'll never forget that glimpse, that driving too at 80 miles an hour and seeing this stuff.
I prefer driving at night.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I do. I used to like to drive more at night more than I do now because I realize when I'm getting older, the vision's not what it once was.
Right, right.
But if I had my druthers, especially when I was young and driving a lot more, I would prefer to drive at night. Mm. And in Germany, that's particularly nice because tractor trailers, or the equivalent that drives around here, actually are not allowed out on the roads after 10 o'clock at night. And they can't drive in the morning until 6. So you don't
have that here. I wish they do that here.
and it's also in Germany, trucks are not allowed to drive on Sundays.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it has its advantages and it has its disadvantages. The disadvantages for the truck drivers, because they have to be somewhere, they have to park, they have to, so they're not home as much. They're, a lot of them live in their trucks. I know a lot of truckers live in their trucks anyhow, but
yeah,
they have to live in their trucks. They actually have no option there. So that's the downside of it. The upside of it is there are very strict rules on how much you're allowed to drive. You can't drive more than 4 hours without taking a break. They have machines in the trucks that write to monitor times that are behind the wheel and that are not behind the wheel, because they're trying to avoid people getting overtired.
People violate
the rules, especially, you know, and we have a lot. Germany, since it's located where it is, it has both north-south traffic. Anything going from Sweden to Italy has to go through Germany. But it also has a lot of east-west traffic. Anything that's coming from the East Bloc, Czechoslovakia, Russia, Ukraine, and whatnot, going to France has to go through Germany. So we just have a hub. We are the cross, you know, Germany is actually the crossroads of Central Europe.
Oh, wow.
So you just have trucks, you know, and we don't have six-lane highways like they do in some places. And the lanes here are a lot smaller than the lanes in the United States because of the space issues that we have. We only have so much space.
Yeah.
When, you know, we might be as big as Montana, but we have 82 times the population, which means we have.
Yeah, right.
So there's a lot more vehicles. Plus we have that crossroads traffic that Montana doesn't get, because who's driving east-west through Montana or north-south? Because in Canada, there's nothing out there either. So,
yeah.
Right. So that reduces. Well, you can want to drive somewhere during the week, and literally you have to be in the left-hand lane because the right-hand lane is full of trucks. I've driven for an hour past the string of trucks, and they're hardly moving. Yeah, because there are just so many of them. There's just one after another.
I don't think I've ever experienced something like that.
No, you wouldn't, because you have more room to spread them out. And you have population centers that, you know, if you're around the coasts, in the East Coast, that you get that sometimes where there's a lot more traffic.
Yeah. You know,
There are places in Cali, you can get on 101 going north, or you can get on, five. And there can be a lot of traffic, but I've never experienced it like it is here. You know.
Yeah. Well,
only widen out into three or four lanes when you get near the big cities.
Right.
You know.
Well, when I was going to Coeur d'Alene, when I turned to Missoula to go to, you know, in that intersection of Butte and Missoula to go to Coeur d'Alene, well, I get 20 miles past there, and it's snowing. Okay, I'm a California kid. I have not had a lot of
snow driving, do you?
No, I don't do it. So my butt was puckering as far as remembering what they tell me. And I'm going down the road, and these truckers are going past me like 80 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Scaring the shit out of me. And then I fortunately nobody was around when I did this. I turned on my headlights. I'm going, oh no, shut that fucker off. No, I don't need that cone effect with the snowflakes coming at the windshield. And
that's a whole different visual.
Doing an Albert Hitchcock, Albert Hitchcock kind of. It's interesting in that liminal dream. She says that, you know, like she mentions driving and getting tired. That's kind of, you're entering into that place. And that can be dangerous if you're driving.
It is. That's the only thing about driving that bothers me, that I'm going to miss that opportunity. I just assume turn off, get off the road. They have a lot of like lay-bys. All those in English, you know, where you can along the interstate, they're just a place where you can kind of pull off.
Rest stops.
Even if there's not a building there, they just have places where you can pull off. A lot of times they have a toilet or something where you can just kind of like get off, get out, walk around a car a couple of times, get back in, and go on. But that's the only thing that kind of bothers me, because I get to that point a lot earlier now, given my age, than I did 20 years ago or 30 years ago.
She was mentioning that, but she mentioned something that actually took place, that if you're a passenger, it's a perfect time to kind of work with the hypoglottic state.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a passenger, and I think that's one of the, what kind of, when I describe about what I seen about Utah and the mountains, and I told you about the sensation I had, I think that I was kind of pretty much in a certain, not deep, but, you know, it was definitely
different. Yeah, it's definitely different, you know. I think that's one of the advantages of being able to drive with someone else.
Yeah.
When we came back from Fort Huachuca, one of the guys that I was going to school with down there, we drove back. He dropped me off in Pittsburgh. He was going up into New York. He was from upstate.
Oh, yeah. I remember. Yeah. Okay.
So we did 4 hours on, 4 hours off of driving because we just drove through.
Yeah.
So whoever wasn't driving was either zoning or sleeping.
Yeah, right.
It was an interesting trip because we traversed the United States in about 48 hours.
Wow.
Because it was just driving.
Yeah.
It started snowing at the Continental Divide and didn't stop until we hit St. Louis.
Ooh.
So that all the snow's gone. But both of us had grown up with snow, so we had a whole different experience.
Okay. Yeah, right.
I noticed that even when it rained in San Jose.
Oh, yeah.
The driving pattern of people changed, and especially if it was fall when the leaves had fallen, you know, that almost black ice, slippery, you can't tell. It was.
Yeah.
It was always a challenge, you know, because it's not something that you encounter all the time.
No, but I think I learned that about the, you know, I was actually working with that kind of, you know, when you're writing with sleeping, especially when I hitchhiked many years ago.
Yeah.
Now I have a vocabulary and understanding of it. And maybe that's why I'm comfortable with it because, I sleep one foot into the hypoglottic and one eye on the driver. Cause I had some rides with people that, that's where you want to develop your sense of vibe. Go ahead.
Yeah, you do. That's exactly what you want to be able to do. You got to feel it before you see it kind of thing.
And there was, I planted a lot of seeds on me and trust and learning to trust that and a lot of different things. And I had a few.
I think it's a great intuition developer. It's too bad
that
school of learning doesn't exist any longer.
Exactly.
You can't do that. That's all gone away. But it was a whole different engagement of the world.
Yeah. And that was in 1976, 77.
Yeah, that's where it was really.
It was part of the hippie, but it began to die out. I'm sure people still hitchhike, but probably not as much. You know, I even experienced, though, even back then, only once, and I think it was in Nebraska. It was in the Midwest, but I was standing on a road, you know, on ramp, and a couple hicks threw rocks at me for hitchhiking.
Yeah, wow.
But proportionally, those kind of incidents were small.
Yeah, they were really
good. The it also builds. Like I tell people, you know, I learned from that there's more good people in the world than there's bad people.
Yes, yes, and
bad
and,
people just get more press.
that is true. But there are lots of good people, a lot of helpful people, and back in. In my day, it was still possible when you were on the road to like work for food.
You could
actually go into a restaurant and spend a couple hours in the kitchen and get fed.
Yeah, and it was acceptable that's
what you were doing, and nobody got all weirded out about the fact that you just walked in and said,
and you were shorter change, but you needed food and stuff. You know, it's interesting you bring that up because I think. Even before hitchhiking, I remember my grandmother especially talking about living through the Depression. Okay.
Yeah.
And she told me about this, how where she lived is that people left their doors unlocked.
Yeah.
So they'd be gone, and a stack of wood would be cut, and they could see that somebody took some lemonade or something, but they left a stack of wood.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. I remember growing up, there were still hobos, and they'd knock on the door asking if they could do something for food. Now, we didn't have a lot. We lived in a suburb of a small town. You know, it was not like there was a lot of work to be done.
So we
generally just, you know, just fed them when they came. You know, give them something to eat. But that was an acceptable thing to do. I remember when we started locking our front door at the house that we lived in.
Because, you do remember that?
Yeah, I remember when we started doing that. And I asked my dad, well, why? And he goes, things aren't like they used to be.
Yeah, right.
And I was probably at the time, I must have been 13, 14. It was the early 60s.
Okay.
He said, okay, well, we'll lock the door. So I remember lots of folks in our neighborhood, the keys to the car were in the visor.
Yeah.
you left them. A lot of people left them in the ignition.
Yeah.
You know, parked out in front of the house. We hardly ever, we never locked our doors until I was 13, 14 years old. It wasn't necessary. Now, and we didn't live in a big city. We weren't in Pittsburgh. People in Pittsburgh locked their doors because they were in the city. But we, you know, Greensburg, where we live, South Greensburg, which is a little borough outside of it. Greensburg had a population of about 20,000 at the time, you know, so it's not this huge megapolis, although a lot of people lived around Greensburg. So if you took the greater Greensburg area, you were probably looking at 40, maybe 50,000 people even then. But still, everybody that was outside of Greensburg kind of had that small town carryover from the days when.
Right.
You could just do some work and there was something there for you. But, you know, there's still places around here, oddly enough, especially at, you know, like when apple season comes around or potatoes. When you drive out to the neighboring town, sometimes you'll just, there's a little covered box, almost kind of like a stand, and there'll be sacks of potatoes and apples in there. And then you can take them, there's a box, and you can drop coins, you know, the coins or your money in there.
There's a couple of places here in Riverside, part of town, that there's still some orange groves, especially if the orange groves are on just like a, there's a house with an orange grove, not a corporate, but they'll put out, like you're saying, they'll put about
bags
for free, or, you know, they'll just trust, donate some money and stuff, you know. Right.
Yes. That's good. That's good to know that they're still that around.
Yeah. It's, you know, there's even now, I don't know if you guys have this, but a few places around where I walk here in Riverside, they have these houses that they built with books in them that people can come by and pick up a book.
Oh, okay. Okay. They're using old telephone booths for that here.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, there's a lot of little towns that they've just filled up the telephone. They didn't tear them out. They're with books, and you can take books or bring books or whatever. And so you have like little
book exchange
libraries all over. Which I think is a really cool idea.
It's a very cool idea, especially anything that's outside the grid of corporate America.
Okay, well, you can tell your upbringing there. So,
it's my upbringing because of, I don't want to get too, my upbringing of not trusting Big Brother.
There's nothing to trust about him, but we all know he's there. And he's always there, and he's always around.
Yeah.
You know? And so, but it's also one of those things you kind of learn to live with. It would be nice to think that people would realize that, you know, the direct personal interaction and that mode of operating and building trust and building, you know, like what's the, oh, I'm trying to think of the English. The interconnectivity between human beings themselves.
You know, right.
The interpersonal relationships, that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Developing true interpersonal relationships actually goes a long way. It's amazing how defenses can be, you know, the wall, we kind of put up fences and walls around ourselves because we've been more or less socialized to think that you can't trust the other.
Yeah.
And it's always nice to hear, and I love to read those kinds of stories where you realize what you can in a lot of instances, and not as many people want as much from you as you've been led to believe that they do.
And you should question your defense mechanism being on all the fucking time.
All the time, yeah. And you're always in high alert, and they're, you know, but yeah, that's how the Americans handled their whole terrorist thing. You know,
oh, yeah.
You never got below orange.
No.
Why? Wait, why not? You know, but yeah. And you were always orange for the wrong reason. You know, you weren't looking inside at who might be coming around the corner. You're always looking at who's coming in from the outside. Well,
yeah, and it's that's why these conversations, a lot of times where it's broadened my vocabulary of and thought process of context is important. Context is important.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, I have so many situations because of how I get around. I'm being on the bus, and yeah, I have my defense system is on. I keep it at a relaxed, alert level until necessary.
Yes, yes.
I don't need to be looking for the boogeyman all the time. Fuck
that. No. And that's actually a good thing to have if you're outside of the United States, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I would assume.
We had to take on for our projects the least expensive mode of transportation. So that meant, you know, you went to the, you flew somewhere and you got the early flight, the late flight, because they're the cheapest ones. And then you got to the, wherever it was, the city. So take public transportation to get into town. You didn't take a taxi cab and you didn't rent a car. You know, so I got to ride buses in a lot of places, and I got to see a lot more of the country than I thought, because a lot of times I didn't speak the language and didn't know where I had to get off. So, you know, you go all the way to the end and the bus driver, and you finally agree, oh, you had to get off like 40 miles back. Oh, okay.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. One time I did that in Spain. It was
40. You missed it by 40 miles?
I missed it by 40. I went all the way to the end of the line to this guy because I told him where I wanted to go, and he said, we passed there. He said, we go there. Well, it was literally, I kid you not, it was literally a post on the side of the road. Didn't have a sign on it, you know, and I guess I missed the town sign going in or what. I went past this post. I only realized that when the other bus that showed up there,
yeah,
because it's a standard route that went up through northern Spain there. But when the other bus driver got there, he said to me, he speaks better English than I do. So we went over to talk to him, and then he said, okay, get on the bus. I'll take you back and I'll tell you where to get off. So I went with him all the way back. They didn't charge me for another ticket or anything. You know, it was like, just, I'll take you back. And then, so then he called out, you know, so like, gringo, here, you know, gringo. Okay, I got it. I'm on, you know, and I get off, and I'm literally in the middle of nowhere. You know, I don't speak Swedish, literally. I mean, there's no town. And I look across the road there, and there looks like something looks like a little train station.
Oh, wow.
And I said, okay, well, that could be helpful. So I go over there, and it's closed. It's all boarded up. It's not used as anything anymore. And so I'm coming out of this train station, walking back up the road, and I hear a voice from the road going, Ed, is that you? And I look up, and I'm going, you know, okay. And I look up, and it was our project leader who was driving to the venue. She had arrived early, was out with her husband and kid. And we're coming back, saw me down there, lost as ever. And I'm going, well, yeah, it's me. And she goes, well, then get in. We'll take you up to the place.
You know,
meeting. Because from this post, you went down the road about 50 meters. And there was a literally a dirt road that went into the woods and up to the top of a mountain. And up there, there was this big it wasn't a big hotel. It was a really nice hotel on the top of this mountain.
Oh, wow.
And that was our meeting place. But there was no sign for it. There was no sign for the community. There's just like, how do you know to get it? Well, they had rented a car, and so they were able to, you know, GPS themselves into where they were going. I was on public transport.
Well, talk about being immersed in interconnectivity.
Yeah.
Because you can be immersed in it, and you still have to orientate, well, where do I turn to make contact?
Where do I go now?
And where do I make contact?
Right. We went for a wine tasting with the people who were putting it on. We came down the hill. She says, over here, and she points, it was getting dark. Over here, and there was another one of those, it was like a post, and on top of it, like a little house, and that little house was a telephone receiver. I don't think I ever would have found it. And she says, all you have to do is pick that up and say I'm at the bottom of the hill and they'll send somebody down.
Oh my God.
But there was no sign. There was nothing written there. There was no way for me to, I can generally kind of follow.
Ed, I feel that you were living in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Sometimes I had the feeling, it's like, what universe am I in? Not just what planet am I on? You know, and this is all within highly developed, technologically savvy, quote unquote, modern day Europe.
You know?
And there's a phone receiver in the tree stump.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Okay. Yeah, I never would have found it. I would have just sat down there at the bottom of the hill.
Yeah,
but it was a beautiful venue. We had a wonderful project. The Swiss guy that was there couldn't sleep because it was too quiet. But
it was too quiet.
It was too. Yeah. Next morning at breakfast, he shows up and I said, "Oh, you know, how you doing? You know, greetings. How did you sleep?" And he goes, "I didn't sleep at all." I said, "Really?" And he goes, "Yeah." He goes, and he said, literally, he says to me, "Have you heard how quiet it is here?
Have you heard?" That is so funny. And it seems odd to me because I would think that Swiss people living where they have a lot of quiet, but I guess I'm wrong.
He was from Lucerne.
Oh, okay.
So, which is, you know, one of the bigger cities. The United Nations has their offices down there. Geneva, okay. Lucerne, they're all full of bureaucrats.
The volume is up.
Exactly. There's lots of light. You know, there's street, and there was no street lights. When it got dark up there, it was dark.
Oh.
And when it got dark, it got quiet. And this was to me one of the most, this is like, finally, you know.
Yeah.
Truly, you know, this is a place you can just kind of let go. You don't have to worry about it at all.
Yeah.
You
can interesting on this subject, because I'm touching back about what we were talking about, you know, when people have a hard time with chatter, with mind, you know, when they're trying to learn to pay attention and stuff and concentrate. And there's this issue of, you know, how you work with the chattering mind and noises and stuff like that. And I don't know who it was. It was somebody I was reading, because I've always been interested in different people giving their different experience. Sometimes you can, you know, but the way it was expressed of, don't fight the noise. Find the little bit of quiet in the noise.
In the noise, yeah.
Find the quiet in the noise.
Yes, yeah, and I think that relates to that Martinist exercise, which grab a thought and just write it, you know. So out of all, you just kind of, literally, it's a blocking out of everything else except that.
Yeah.
And so it's in a different way of refocusing of your attention. I'm not focusing on my breath now. I'm focusing on the thought.
Yes, right.
Doing the same thing, because that's what it's trying to get. I think the exercises are designed to do is to get you to focus enough that you can start blocking out or sorting out or weeding out the things that you don't, that are distracting to you.
Yeah, and stop being overwhelmed by thought itself.
Yeah, because you realize that there's a gazillion abstractions, and when you get it down to a half a dozen, it becomes manageable in some way.
Yeah, and so I put it on a very physical level, because that the way I translate that is like learning how to do a move in wrestling. You keep for working example. one move.
Yeah.
You know, just how to hook up or how to whatever, but you find one thing you need to try to change, you know, that you're going to use that you actually have to keep practicing with.
Yes.
So that you get from, you can, it's second nature. You don't have to think about it.
Right. You know? Right. That's that automatic part that comes into driving. We do a lot of that way. And it's for that reason that we've done it again and again and again until it's been internalized.
Yeah. And that's, from,
you know, playing a harmonica. There's just something you just do it again and again and again and again, you know, until you forever be able to play a blues scale.
Yeah.
But if you don't practice it, you can't do it anymore.
Oh yeah. And it goes to the way I have a book that Alan Watts, it's a pamphlet called, the Art of Contemplation.
Ah, okay.
It's just a pamphlet he put out. Yeah. I think it was repeated in a book, but in that, and it's always been a kind of a, I come back to, but one of the things he explains how your breath, the unique thing about your breath and why it's used so much is it's both automatic and you can influence it.
Yes.
It serves both purposes.
Both purposes.
You can't totally control your breath, but you can influence the rate or, you know, your attention.
Yes.
You can work with it. So what I liked about that is bringing a certain acceptance of automatic with, but that's like in a car. A car is automatic. It's not, some cars are automatic, but you still have to pay attention to how you're driving it.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? Exactly. Mm-hmm. You don't take it for granted. I mean, I like sticks personally. I like using my feet and stuff. But when I started driving automatics, I had to retrain myself of not take it for granted in a way. It affected my attention because when my attention was – I had to you understand what I'm saying.
I know exactly what you're saying. I had a standard transmission car until 2010.
Okay.
And that when I bought the car that I have right now, it's a little older model and it's an automatic because when you're in a big city, and I'm sure if you were driving a lot in Riverside after a while, you think about it for a while.
Yeah, right.
You're constantly clutching.
Yes,
that just gets to be nervy, you know. And in San Jose, it was like, oh, I have to do this. So when we finally ended up, the first cars we had here when we came to Germany, because my daughters had licenses from California, but there's no agreement between California and Germany, so they had to redo their driver's license. There is an agreement between Germany and South Dakota. So if you have a license in South Dakota, you don't have to redo your driver's license in Germany. And there's an agreement between Germany and Pennsylvania. So when I got out of the Army, they simply gave me a German license because I had already had one. So it all depends on where you're from. So coming from California, which is probably the most vehicular state in the United States. In a lot of regards, I'm sure that it is. They had to redo their license. So I insisted that they learn how to drive a standard transmission car.
Okay.
So everybody in my family can drive a standard transmission. In the meantime, almost everybody has automatics because the German manufacturers are now coming around to the way the American manufacturers were and are simply making the automatic the standard. The automatic becomes the standard and the standard becomes the exotic that you get.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Go figure. We know it's cheaper to produce, but what the heck? So they all learn to drive on standard transmission cars. And I prefer to drive them as long as I don't have to drive them in the city somewhere.
Makes sense.
Now that I'm here where I am, it wouldn't bother me to have a standard transmission anymore, except that my wife with her artificial joints goes, I don't want to do that. So, but I'm hoping I don't have to get another car for a while. So, I'm not a big car fan anyhow. I've never been one of these people. That,
yeah. Well, when I went to teach my daughter, both my kids, I put them in cars between the age of 12 and 14, in safe areas. I just started getting them used to drive, in the fields and my daughter was this big parking lot that here in Riverside that, it, I mean, it was huge. So, and it was vacant on the weekends. And I had, I had a Honda Civic that had a standard in it. Well, so the way I taught her is the way I had to learn something I learned that helped me cross over from with my attention of how I pay attention driving a standard and an automatic. You guess what it was? Feel your ass. Feel your ass. Because it's just like, whether you're in a standard, it's your ass feeling the movement of the car. Because what I did with my daughter, I put her in the car and I said, now go fast. You know, and she got it up to maybe 20 or 30 miles an hour. I said, now brake. I did that for an effect. I wanted her to literally experience the power of the car.
And, so it's that old driving by the seat of your pants.
But, you know, as far as an experiential, now you don't want
to. Well, that's the whole thing. You have to experience the whole vehicle.
Yeah, exactly. That's it.
Yeah, and I think getting it through your ass is probably a good way to do that, because it slides around this. Even when you have to clutch or you have to accelerate, you feel that all the way up your legs. You know, there's that whole, you know, and that's the thing that I think too many people overlook. I went through driver training in high school, not to learn how to drive, but so that I could get a discount on my insurance. I used to drive. We had the learner's permit. If somebody had a license, they could sit in the front seat and you could drive the car with a learner's permit. Well, I drove to school every day for driving school, and I took it in the summer. I didn't have my license yet, but I was to that point where I could, because my dad started with me relatively young. He let me back up the car in front of the house or drive it forward. You know, we had a relatively open street. But it gets you to understand when he said, you know, just take it back one car length, how far that is.
Right.
Well, getting a feel for what, you know, the size of the vehicle in the United States.
That's the thing.
Getting big cars, you know.
The feel for it, because part of the reason when I learned to drive, at 16, my mom taught me. They taught me in such a way that it didn't agree with me. And for the longest time, Ed, I had more accidents because I think people, the way they taught me, didn't help me feel have that feeling.
It was too.
And the way we talk, it was too mentalized.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so you know, before my daughter came along, that I had to unlearn that kind of way of driving. And one of the things that helped that actually my daughter that I think I used to in connection is I had a period where I rode horses. I was on horses, you know, and my daughter at 12 was riding horses. So I think I didn't think this out. It was an intuitive leap trying to connect to her the riding of the horse and the you know, that ass effect, you know.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that Chumpa Rinpoche, in teaching meditation way back when, he had the Tibetans always for a long time enjoyed horses, you know, to travel. And he basically drew a metaphor of sitting on the cushion is taking your seat on a horse.
Okay.
So that you don't leave out that groundedness or sensation. When there's going to be a lot, like we were talking about, that wandering and that loosening of our defense system, of how to relax with our defense system. And riding a horse is a good way to learn. I know a lot of people are afraid of them, and but I've been around them, and you know, I don't take it for granted, because I've been bitten by one. And when you're feeding them, they like to use their snout. Hurry up, I'm hungry.
Yeah. I'm not a big horse person either. When we were in when you're down in Fort Wegacha in Arizona, there's not a whole lot to do.
Yeah.
But you can go horse riding for $1 an hour.
Oh wow.
Yeah. So there was a couple of guys that could ride horses, and then they always dragged me along.
Yeah.
And I always ended up with the weirdo horse or something.
No wonder you don't like horses.
But these horses had more issues than I did. You know, so we could have probably gotten along really well if we had some way to communicate. And I was on this, so I could get on it and I could ride. I was having trouble when it was galloping or when, because I don't know how to do that. I wasn't taking lessons. I recall.
Yeah. You were learning by the seat of your pants.
I was learning by the seat of my pants. And I was on this horse one. His name was Blue. He was the most ornery sucker. He made me look like a piker, you know? So when we were out, we got out of the corral and we went down the trail, and we were with this one guy. He was from Hawaii. He was a real horse person. He rode bareback. And we're kind of like going down the trail and we're trotting, and I'm really proud that I'm making it this far. And I see this guy coming at me at full gallop. This horse is being chased by Satan, you know? Well, the horse I'm on, Blue, sees this and figures, I don't know what he figures. It's like, well, I have to get into this, or maybe there's danger, or we have to do this. And this horse, like, it was just like in a cartoon. I had a feeling it, like, jumped up, turned around 180 degrees, and took off at full kilt with me on it, you know? I managed to get back to the corral.
On the horse?
I did not fall up. It was one of those, I am holding on for dear life.
You know, right.
And I made it back to the corral. It turns out that since, you know, there's so many rattlesnakes and things on it, the Hawaiian guys we were with, his horse got spooked by a rattlesnake and took off. And he didn't have anything to control it other than the reins that he had. So the horse was like, I don't care about you. I'm looking out for me.
Right. Your horse is going, well, I'm getting out. I'm following. I'm getting out.
That's right. If he can do it, I can do it. So I'm out of here. So he's back. Because Blue loved to be back in the corral. That's where he wanted to be. It was my my feeling. You know, and he got back there. So, but we got back in one piece. So I've always appreciated Blue for that. That he didn't go out of his way to get rid of me to get back. We just went back. We managed that. But that's just like as far as I ever got with horse riding. But I love horses and I love animals. It's a great interaction, and I would have enjoyed being able to partake of it a little more if I had had the chance, but we just didn't get around to that part of it.
Well, it really worked out for my daughter, even though at the time when we divorced and I left the house, my wife immediately got my daughter into horseback riding. I had her in a keto.
Yeah.
Because I wanted her, both, mainly her. I still come from the place, know and be comfortable with your body, and you're less likely, you know, to get your defense system go crazy because you haven't learned how to relate to them.
Right.
You know?
That's why your example with, you know, your ass in the car is actually a good one, because it's that experiential side of things that too often gets overlooked. You know, it's like you said, your parents taught you too mentally to drive a car.
Yeah.
And it's not a mental thing. It's really a whole body thing.
Well, yeah. And it informs what you come to understand mentally of, I got to turn on my blinker and stuff. So, it's just, you got to ground it there so that you can use the mental to move through traffic, you know?
You can. It's, you know, what disappoints me the most these days is that I see lots of people around here, they buy these really high-class, expensive cars.
Yeah.
And they don't spend the extra 10 euros or 20 euros on what it takes to get a turn signal.
What? They don't come with turn signals?
No, they come with turn signals, but I don't ever see one blinking.
I want to go
up to them after one and go, it's really sad you spent all that money in the car and you didn't get a turn signal. What are you thinking? You know,
I missed that one. Okay.
I know. Because that just irks me to no end. I'm turning. Okay. But it's not something I may have to tell you, turn on your turn signal a couple of times. At some point in time, it has to be automatic.
Oh, yeah.
You know, oh, yeah. But then again, yeah. I learned to ride a bicycle back in the days when it was expected that bicycle riders would use hand signals.
Yeah.
Well,
right.
Actually, there was still a lot of cars running around when I was when I was young that you had to use because they didn't have turn signals.
Yeah, and see, up until about 3 years ago, I haven't had a car since 2007.
Oh, okay.
The last car I have took a shit, and I just with my income, I said, nope, I'm not buying another one. I can't afford it. Mm-hmm. Insurance, all that. So I started riding a bicycle, mixing with bicycle and busing. Sometimes I'd bike part of the way home and my dad picked me up, you know, yep. It's 9 miles and stuff, but it kept me in shape. And so I was on the road for a long time as a bicyclist.
Mm-hmm.
And learning, that gave me another heightened sense, not hyper, heightened sense of I'm moving through traffic.
Yeah.
Things
yeah.
that can hurt me.
Yes.
You know, but I want to keep moving, you know, so that's been a part of my whole somatic intelligence learning skill. And my mm-hmm. daughter, even though I resisted her going the horse, it turned into one of those things that if you just slow down, maybe what appears to be negative has something positive in it. And sure enough, it did. That I was the one that was, because my ex-wife had to work. I wasn't working, but I had a car and I take my daughter to her classes for her horse to ride her class. I interacted with her a lot around it. A lot of it was just us being in silent to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. It was just troublesome to me, but I had to learn to accept it because of the divorce. And that's the way Christy needed to, but I wish there was more. I'm just saying, I wish that there was some more talking time, but it brought forth a lot of positive because I got to see her develop a horseman, you know, horse person's skill. And if anything, it just challenged, you know, I wanted her in karate for, you know, to have that physical skill, but she learned it with a 1,000 pound horse. So I'm going, well, if she's good at this, then she's going to have some, that's what I want. I want her to feel confident if she runs in within some kind of reason, if she runs into something physical that she knows how to work with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And especially as a female, I think males need to do it too, but I've been on
different
this
reasons.
Yeah. Different reasons. I just think when it crosses over it, and this is where I like sports, is learning how to interact with your body under different kind of, you know, situations.
Yeah.
So, you know, it turned out to be really good. And I about 3-4 years ago, my daughter went with her mom to New York City and they live on Rhode Island or something. And my daughter took a day trip all by herself to go to the Empire State Building. She went down to Central Park. She went to this nice restaurant, showed a picture where she had wine and dinner by herself. And Kathy's relatives goes, she's going to go out by herself? And Kathy goes, yeah, she's a lot like her dad.
Mm-hmm. There's lots of ways to pay compliments.
Yeah, right. Thank you for saying that. I know the way I'm taking it.
Hey. Sometimes others don't expect that you'll do things that you end up doing. And sometimes sometimes we do have that, you know, it's not like the luck of the Irish per se, but, you know, a lot of us walk through the valley of the shadow of death, not knowing that that's even where we are kind of thing.
Yeah, that's so true.
Really. I mean, sometimes ignorance is bliss and sometimes naivete, you know, helps you out. I remember when we were in college, there was a bunch of us, we decided we were going to go to New York and have a couple of beers. Well, it's an 8-hour drive to New York City. You know, so we got in a car and drove to New York City.
Yeah.
And we were in a fraternity, so we went to the fraternity house, and it happens to be up in the Bronx. And we said hello and checked in and said, we're going downtown for a beer. And they said, okay. You know, nobody said, don't do it. You know, we went outside the door, and they had already started a pool of how many of us would make it back uninjured.
Oh shit!
We found out later, and so we went downtown to this to this bar, walked in, and the bartender wouldn't even serve us. He ignored us until the guy that drove, he says, look, I just drove 8 hours to have a beer in this bar, and I'm not leaving until I get one. And the guy turned around, and he goes, okay, one. So he pours us a beer, and we ordered another, and he's not reacting. This is like the whole afternoon kind of thing. Well, then we were hungry, and we decided we were going to order, and we wanted to get some pizza. You know, he didn't have anything to eat in the bar, and we asked him, can we order in pizza? And the guy goes, yeah, if you order for everybody in the bar. Okay, yeah. Well, there was the four of us and two other guys. Okay. what the hell? There's enough pizza for everybody to go around. Can we have another beer? You know, and so it was like this whole afternoon of developing rapport in this bar that we were at with the people that were there and the locals or whatever. And so we just sat there because that's what we went to New York for, to sit in the bar and have a couple of beers because we couldn't do that in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
We did that. And then we had our pizza and we went back up the hill to the fraternity house, and all four of us showed up again unscathed. That's when it came out, because there was only one guy who said, I don't think any of them are going to get hurt. And he won the pool. And he so he bought a couple of, he bought a case of beer and brought it in. And we all sat around to exchange experiences about how they thought we were going to survive New York. Yeah. But none of them could, because one of the fraternity brothers had been mugged down there, the day before. One of those things, because it's not like that. But sometimes you just happen to, you have your angels are around you, or you're just so naive that people go, oh, they're not from here, or they wouldn't be doing that.
That's very true.
And everybody just goes, I can't. The locals are amazed.
get amazed. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've had several
lucky experiences. Sometimes it doesn't turn out that way. Sometimes it can turn out very badly. But you have to take what comes. But it's good, as you always point out, to be in some way ready for that, or prepared for that, or to be aware that that's there, or to have some sense of how do I react in an unexpected situation.
Because what my experience has taught me, if anything, and it goes to, we've talked about it, it's learning how to relate to your defense system and your experience of being in this kind of experience, like you tell, or another one where you mugged. Mm-hmm. I think what's become important to me is not to be attached to either one of those, good or bad.
No.
That taking a risk is not good or bad, but good or bad can come of it.
Can come of that, yes.
Because I guess maybe for me, I get claustrophobic if I can't take a certain, even a low-level risk.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Know? Yeah,
and I'll ground it in this way. It's like getting my hip surgeries, okay, going through that, and there was a risk involved. Well, what's going to happen?
Yeah.
I don't know how it was going to affect me, And afterwards, this is where I'm applying what I'm trying to articulate, the risk of getting up and having to walk and learning to – and in a lot of ways, learning how to walk again.
Again, yes. I was. Did you have both hips replaced or just one?
Both. Both of them are titanium.
my wife's are too.
Yeah. And the thing is what I found interesting is the doctor I had. I mean, I went in for the left because that was worse, but he had taken the pictures and he talked to me like a person to show me what I was looking at, that I would be looking at the other one. And sure enough, 2 years later, I went in and I said, it seems like it's time.
Okay.
And I wanted to do it before I got too much older too.
Okay. All right. There's a lot of, there are some places that do both hips. Whenever one goes, they do both.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the problems that my wife has. When they did the one hip, there's a leg differential because of the how they put these together. And so you're kind of off balance for a while until the other one gets done. And in that period of time, you walk cattywampus.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
And that's part of what contributed to her back problem.
Yes.
Because you're skewed.
Yeah.
And depending on, you know, how high that is and how well they can accommodate
That's very true. Yeah, that makes sense.
She got the second hip and it balanced out again. That was helpful, but the damage had already been done.
Yeah, because the muscle habituation.
Yes, that's
muscle habituation
problem.
that's not talked about or help people. Given that situation, I informed myself. I knew that I had to pay attention to my muscle habituation when I just had the one.
Yeah.
Because I was tuned into, because of my accident before this, of the chronic pain in my muscles and reading about a lot of chronic pain or the intensity of chronic pain that a lot of people have. You can have chronic pain, but if you're maintaining a certain intensity, Ed, part of it is you need to lessen it, you have to actually retrain the habituation that the muscles have to guard against the rate, because it's the guarding of the injury that's causing the pain to intensify and not flow through, you know, because it's cramping down and you're going to guard. There's more energy. That's going to, you know, it's kind of a simple fluid physics problem. In terms of blood flow and the muscles.
And right. You have that added component of being aware of that, and that's what's happening in order to be able to deal with that or work against it.
Yeah, it's basically a kinesthetic awareness. This is a book I read called Living a Pain-Free Life, and he's an orthopedic, and he's trying to bring, at the time, this was 5-10 years ago, of they need more understanding of what the muscles are doing, not just the bones.
Yes, yes.
You know, so, and I like that. And basically, he educated me, and he's trying to educate in kinetic awareness. And this is where movement and dance, that to use your breath and actually turn towards the pain and use your breath to relax that muscle from tightening, to actually use your breath or stretching to loosen it rather than being habituated to it being that way. Now, when you start it, it's going to feel uncomfortable because you're reconditioning the muscles. You're changing the habit. And there is going to be a little bit. Take hot showers. Take hot showers and feel good about yourself. You know?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And some of this, too, it's amazing, I want to say, is that if you understand – to me, if you understand that some of this is elemental, like Sherlock Holmes, it's about understanding the elements that are playing into what's affecting you. You know, like the guardedness and using hot water, you know, stretching and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's really helped me a lot because I'm 65, and I know that my body and the way I relate to it is a lot better than, God bless him, but my father, just both my parents came from that era, that, and I came from the next era. I was down in San Diego and came from the holistic health movement of people understanding their bodies and not just giving in to the doctor telling you, you know, what you can or can't do with your body.
I can understand that. There was a, you know, a long time, but where they even got like joint replacement. You know, my experience of old people was they didn't get up, they didn't walk, they couldn't for the most part, because they all had bad hips, bad knees, they had bad something or other, and there was nothing you could do about it.
Right.
And so, you know, old people were associated with sitting.
Yes.
They could still sit, you know, and it was all a matter of how cushioned the sitting was.
Yes,
that you could get to, because, you know, I know even my wife's parents, they still had some farming that they were doing on the side up until the grandparents died in the late 60s. were doing that. And these are people that simply had worked their joints kaput.
Yeah, right.
For lack of a better word, because what else, that's what you did. And you did it until you couldn't do it any longer. You know?
Well, and because I was in maintenance, also what I'm sharing is all these factors now kind of coalescing. But because I worked in maintenance, we were all about, what's the term for it? Ergonomics of how we use our bodies and the wear and tear because of the misuse of the way we lifted or repetitive motion with your body without, okay, take a break. You know, so I was informed by that a lot too.
Those
you were talking about with the farmers, they didn't have that kind of input.
No. When I came to Germany in 1972, they were still mowing their fields with scythes in part.
Oh my God.
Yes, and turning it with rakes, you know.
Oh my God.
This is 1972. Everybody go, oh, industrialized. No, there are places here. I even saw they were rare, but they were rare. But I did see horses plowing fields. You know, so they had horse-drawn plows. They had these things, but it was not uncommon, especially here where I'm living right now, where the family went out and literally mowed the hay with. And gathered and raked it together into thing. And they did have a baling machine. That was like the big thing. But you had to get it cut. You had to get it put into rows. It had to be dry. And then the baler came through and made bales out of it. But they were all hand loaded onto trailers. Wow. It wasn't like, they just spit out a roll somewhere. And these days you get these rolls of stuff and the tractor comes out and it's got a forklift on the front of it and can pick it up and stack it on a trailer. None of that happened back then.
I seen some of that up in Montana.
Yeah. Okay.
Up in Montana, they do that big, huge fucking rolls.
Yes. Okay. Well, they're not huge here, but that's kind of like the preferred baling method these days because I guess it's easier to do it.
Yeah. Probably more.
I don't know what the machinery does, but
The things that. How things have changed. That's what I'm paying attention to now. Yeah. How things have changed, and a lot of things for the good, I think, I'm grateful, for having lived at a time where I learned a lot about my, how to relate to my body and stuff.
Yeah. Because,
I mean, for a long time, Ed, I'm not kidding, until I was about 30, I had so many fucking speeding tickets and I got in accidents with machinery, and I know a lot of it was until I got into meditation. My brain, my mind thought it could just hijack my body, without any consideration that really, talk about deficient rational.
I never had to suffer from a lot of accidents, but speeding tickets is still a bit of an
What is it about bales and speeding tickets?
You live in a country like I do now where there are posted speed limits, okay?
Yeah.
And a lot of the Autobahn has posted speed limits. It's not like you can just get on the Autobahn and drive as fast as you want. But there are still areas where there are none.
Oh, wow.
So on secondary roads, if it's not the Autobahn, the speed limit's 100 kilometers an hour, which is 60 miles an hour.
Okay.
About that, roughly. So when I drive down to Fulda, it's a secondary road. It's actually a federal highway that goes from here to Fulda. So when I drive down there, every time you come to where there's an intersection of some sort where roads are coming in from the side, they usually have that posted as 80 kilometers an hour, which is about 48, about 50. Mm-hmm. So, you kind of have to slow down. And when you go through if you go into any community, once there's a yellow sign that says this is where the community starts, the speed limit is 50 kilometers an hour. Mm-hmm. So they don't have to post those things. You just know what they are.
Okay.
So, and it's all up to you, even when you're on the Autobahn and you're driving, if you're not within a community of some sort, you're not within what's, what we would call an incorporated area.
Yeah, right.
if you are more than 10 kilometers over the speed limit in an incorporated area, you'll get points. Otherwise, you just have to pay what I like to call the entertainment tax. And if you're outside of that, you can be up to 20 kilometers over the speed limit. Uh-huh. If there's one posted. And then you only pay the fine if they, if they're monitoring it in any way. But there's not like police sitting there. You will never see a police car sitting on the side of the road in Germany.
Oh, is that right?
No, never. It's all done. It's all done with radar. It's, and you, they, and the thing that's nice about it is when they send you the speeding ticket, they send you your picture.
Yeah.
It's on there, and they go, and if this is not you, you can come down here and say to us, it's not me, and then you can start that whole process. You don't have to say who it is that was on there. You just have to go down and go, well, that's not me. Now, they may ask you a lot of questions about whether you know who's driving your car at that time.
That's my twin.
Yeah, it could be, whatever. But, you know, silence is sometimes golden because you don't have to speak. But, you know, so I have this whole stack of speeding tickets because I tend to get them more. I don't pay attention or I am going too fast. The couple of times where I really should have been penalized, for some reason, they didn't have the machines turned on.
Wow.
So I didn't get my picture taken. But this can happen also in the middle of the night, and you get a picture of you that you can recognize as you. It's I mean, that they have developed this technology. As a matter of fact, we have one right down the street here. It's probably no more than 50 meters from our house.
Wow.
You get on the street, and it's for, you know, because this is a 50 zone right here because it's still within the community. And people coming down to the highway that's down here tend to slow down because they're going to be getting on the highway. But people that get off the highway have been driving a little faster and tend to speed up this way.
Okay.
And so they have these columns that are standing there. And the thing is, and the nice thing about Germany, most places they post signs that there is a radar machine up ahead that's going to take your picture if you're driving too fast.
Yeah.
I mean, you've been warned. You've been warned. That's right. And so when it happens to you and you go in and go, well, that was unfair, or, you know, they go, what? You don't know what the rule. And that's the other thing I like about Germany. If you do have a traffic violation, you can always go to court. And the first thing the judge is going to ask you is, didn't you go to driving school and don't you know the rules?
Yeah, right.
That's the first thing that's going to happen. It's not whether there were signs posted or whether it is. There are rules. If there are no signs anywhere, everybody knows how to drive. I told you once about that village in northern Germany that just took out all the traffic signs.
Yeah, you did.
The number of accidents reduced because people started paying attention to what they were doing instead of just following the signs.
Exactly.
And it does have an effect. So there's like this baseline that's just a little higher than it is most places. You know, we don't have to tell you, you should know. So. Yeah,
right. Right. Exactly.
I pay my entertainment tax regularly. And then.
That's why you call it an entertainment tax. Yeah. Entertainment
tax. Well, I think the one that I enjoyed the most is when the first time I was here in Germany, I used to have to drive to Fulda every day. I taught English down there at the education center. I had this little VW bug. You know, it never drove too fast, but if there is a speed limit somewhere, you should follow it. And I just kind of, it was an 80 zone, and I went through there at like 90 kilometers an hour.
Oh, wow.
And back in those days, they actually did sometimes have guys out there with one of those radar guns that were, you know, then down at the next lay-by, you know, where you could pull off the road, there was a police car, and a guy had this stick with this round circle in and a flashing red light that he would wave and tell you to pull in, you know. And you could pull in, and then he would tell you what you did wrong, and, you know, and it was going to cost that. Back then, speeding ticket was about 20 marks, and you paid it on the spot.
You know,
the policeman said, that'll cost you 20 marks, so you paid him 20 marks, and you went on your way, okay? So I got flagged for speeding going to Fulda one week. The next week, coming the other way, same area stretch of road, so going in the other direction, I get flagged again and I get pulled in.
The same police officer?
Same police officer. And he walks up to the car and he looks in it and he goes, "You're a slow learner, aren't you?"
I love it. I love it. That's good.
I said, apparently so.
Yeah.
Reaching into my wallet, got out that 20 euros, and he goes, "The chances are good we'll be here next week too."
Oh, he let you know.
Yeah, very kind, very, you know, our friend, your friend and helper, the policeman, and he was willing to put the, I never saw him again. I didn't get another speeding ticket in the same place.
Well, I was just thinking, maybe if you did see him, you'd pull, without, no, you didn't, pull over. Hey, I learned my lesson.
If I had seen him, I'm sure I would have driven back. Okay. Go, I made it this time.
Yeah,
exactly. He probably would have given me a ticket for driving the wrong way or turning around where I wasn't supposed to.
That's amazing. Well, I'm going to get off here. We've been on here an hour and a half.
It's been
the two of us, and it's been nice chatting. Yeah. We'll see how everybody takes to our, chatting.
Our musings. Yes.
and I'll talk to you down the road. Okay.
You take care.
Thank you very much, Ed. Thank you.
Right. Enjoy.
Bye-bye. Bye. Yeah.